91.3 FM WLVR Bethlehem. You're listening to the Fritz Rock Show. We just heard a bunch of stuff from Ian Anderson there. That was Rupee's Dance. That's the title cut from that album. We also heard The Water Carrier from the digitally remastered acoustic Jethro Tull. Two Short Planks. That's a deep cut you don't hear too often. We also played Heavy Horses. And I gave you a rare track from Jethro Tull. And this was from 1981, I believe, Crew Nights. And we started this set with Teacher, and which is pretty apropos for who we're going to be talking to. A man who truly doesn't need an introduction, the world's recognized pioneer and founder of flute rock, Ian Anderson. Welcome back to the Fritz Rock Show, Ian.
Well, thank you very much indeed. That was certainly an introduction, whether I needed it or not.
You know, you said that the last time, but there's so much I can talk about you. We haven't chatted for a while. Last time I talked with you was in 2005, but what I really want to bring attention to is the fact that you are coming back to the Pennsylvania area.
That's right, and coming back, I hope, with a bunch of songs, which are going to be entertaining for those folks who've seen Jethro Tull in the last few years, or even me on a solo tour. Because I'm, as always, trying to find some new stuff to play, so we don't just repeat ourselves endlessly with a catalogue of greatest hits. It's more like a different look at some of the Jethro Tull repertoire. Some of it very familiar, some of it deep catalogue things that you wouldn't find readily played on most radio stations. So we kind of look into the old Jethro Tull stuff and find some songs, a couple of which perhaps we've never played before.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
And then, there's a be a bunch of new songs too, because I think we currently play two new songs on Jethro Tull dates during the last few months, and I'll be playing those in October, November in the USA, and also a couple of new ones which I have yet to. Makes a couple little demos of and send to the other musicians so that they can be familiar with them by the time we get together for rehearsal.
Can you tell us a little bit about what we can expect on stage as far as the instrumentation and how this set is going to be presented?
Well, it'll be a concert in two halves with an intermission, and the first half will be predominantly the acoustic material. The second half will be more of an electric performance. So that's the broad division, but it's always tricky because there are a lot of Jethro Tull songs that are essentially rock songs, but they still have some passages of acoustic music, if for no other reason than the fact that my main instrument, the flute, is an acoustic instrument. So we've always straddled, if uneasily, that line between acoustic and electric presentation. And in broad terms, it's a little bit more acoustic and esoteric in the first half, a bit more electric and a bit more rocky in the second half, but there's bound to be some areas of cross-fertilization between the two.
Oh, well, we always like that, and especially our listeners. You could tell from what I just played there before we chatted. Our listeners truly appreciate the deep cuts, and I think it's so refreshing when an artist such as yourself will go back and review his catalog and over 250 songs and more, and say, well, let's dust this one off and see what we can do with this and change it up a little bit. It's kind of a way to give a fresh new spin to some of the material that maybe doesn't always get heard at an Ian Anderson or a Jethro Tull performance. So we think that's wonderful.
Yeah, and there's some pretty well-known Jethro Tull songs that, we do have other arrangements for that are, just put them in a slightly different light and change the context somewhat. So it's a mixture of all sorts of things. But the thing is, you can never please everybody all the time.
Right.
Everybody comes. It's so easy to talk about audiences if they're just one group of like-minded people, or even to dress them up in a national flag and say that's a Swiss audience, or that's a German audience, or that's a Turkish audience. It isn't like that. You walk out on stage, the first thing that hits you is you're looking at a whole sea of individuals, who span gender, race, culture, religion. I mean, it's so broad almost everywhere we play. And that's the first thing I have in my head, is I'm not out there singing to a Swiss audience. I'm singing to, a couple of thousand individuals who are actually not probably so different to, how they would be if they were from a different country. It's just, I think the difference between individual people is far greater than the difference between their you know, the colors of their national flag or the language they speak or whatever. So, I mean, I try and keep in mind I'm singing to individuals, and it's not that easy to treat them, or for me to treat them just as one uniform bunch. And so I think you can't please everybody all the time. Everybody's there for, you know, perhaps a slightly different, with different expectations and perhaps with different preferences. So I figure if I can have the feeling that at the end of a concert I've, you know, had kind of an 80% hit rate with most of the people, that's about all I could expect. I would be surprised if people leaving a show said, "Well, I just loved everything they played."
Yeah.
I mean, I'd expect them to say, "Well, I like this and I like that," but that wasn't, you know, my kind of cup of tea, or I didn't like it when he did that, or when he. I mean, that's kind of healthy, you know.
Sure.
I think if you go out there and try and please people, you go out there and just try to be, you know, what they want you to be, you will actually probably please nobody, including yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to go out there and, you know, be yourself and go out there
and have
to do
fun.
What you want to do, because it gives you a kick. It gives you the challenge and the satisfaction. And if that's the case, it becomes more likely to be evident to the audience, and there's more likely they share in that spirit if they can see that you are engaged in what you're doing for your own personal reasons.
It's so refreshing to hear that, how you view your audiences as individuals, because, you know, I think so much in today's culture we're really being pushed towards the collective and being part of the beehive, and instead of being the individuals and celebrating the individuality of our human existence. So I think it's wonderful to hear that from you, Ian.
Well, I think there's a danger when you've been around for a lot of years and you're playing repertoire which you've played perhaps for 20, 30, 40 years, then you've got to keep it fresh. And alive for you. And I remember reading an interview with Sting, who said that he didn't like to think about the lyrics to his songs when he sang them. He just sang them as words and didn't want to get kind of emotionally involved in the meaning of them for whatever reason. And my approach is quite the opposite. You see, I really do think about the words that I'm singing, and I think about the way that I want to deliver them, and it may be not quite the same from night to night, but I'm very much trying to, when I sing a song, I'm trying to see pictures in my head of what that song is about, and, you know, and I have my little visual references in the back of my mind when I'm singing a song like Aqualung. It actually is about something very real to me, and I have pictures in my head to go with that reality, and, you know, it's quite important to me to do that. I think if I just found myself just singing the words without getting caught up in what it's about, then I think I would deserve a smack around the ear.
It's refreshing to hear that too. Well, that's obvious. I've seen you many times over the years, and you know, besides being the front man for your career, there's a genuine honesty when you're up there on the stage, and I think that comes across to all of the fans who come out to see you. So I really think that you're on the money with that, and I'm sorry to hear that Sting even said that, because
I'm paraphrasing somewhat. I'm sure that he didn't mean it to sound as if he just didn't care.
But
I think his point was that he didn't feel...
It's a different approach.
He didn't feel ready to immerse himself in the emotion of the lyrics, perhaps because he didn't trust himself to do that and play the right notes at the same time. But whatever the reason, you know, that did strike me as being quite the antithesis of my own approach. And I know how difficult it is for people who sing music again and again and again. I remember seeing Frank Sinatra playing live towards the end of his career, and obviously he was, you know, something of a shadow of the Frank Sinatra that we might have known from when I was a child, for example. But you know, I think there was something still to me that made it real, you know, that his vocal abilities were clearly not what they were, but the delivery and the sentiment and the expression seemed to be there. And as an actor too, I guess he learned to do that. And whether he was just making it look convincing or whether he really was immersed in the lyrics he was singing, I don't know. But I guess a skilled performer and one who does have acting experience can do that and fool us.
Yeah.
I know when I go to the theater, I'm always thinking, I wonder how that guy's actually feeling today. You know, is he, you know, what was in his head, you know, an hour before he went on stage? You know, did he just, you know, just get a a nasty letter from his bank manager? did he have a row with his wife 10 minutes before he walked on the stage? Is he going to have a row with his wife when he goes off the stage? You know, I mean, all these things, you know, I find myself thinking, you know, what is it like, you know, just having to banish reality for a, you know, for an hour and a half on a theatre stage? And it makes it difficult for me to enjoy watching other performers, particularly those from the more thespian side of things, because I know that, you know, it's quite a, you know, quite an act and quite an art to put yourself really into character. Quite a tricky jog. I'm glad I'm just a humble musician and not trying to earn a living doing the whole shebang of being an actor. That's very difficult.
But somehow, I don't know, I could imagine you doing it. I really could. Even if it was just for fun, I could imagine you doing it, because you're quite the character yourself, Ian.
Yeah, but I think I'm one of those people who's only ever been... I've been offered a few roles in cinema, and like selling ice cream, cleaning the carpets. No, I had to actually clean the car. I was actually a cinema cleaner once before I became a musician full time. But the kind of roles that I was offered, apart from the fact that I really didn't think I had the skill to do it, but yeah, they were a little stereotypical, and you know, I find I don't think I'd want to play a part, you know. Playing myself, I think that would be a little wacky.
A little strange, yeah.
I have a son-in-law who's an actor, and of course I, you know, watch him on TV or in movies or whatever, and
yeah,
it's kind of brings you a little closer to the reality that it is quite a different world to the one that I inhabit in the public domain anyway. So, yeah, difficult job, not for me.
And how is the family? How's Shona and your son and your daughter? How is your family doing, Ian?
I think they're doing okay. My wife and I are both working in the office, and my son James was here yesterday. We had a concert and at a festival at the weekend, and he went back last night. And my daughter just arrived back from Atlanta with her husband and her two very small children, having spent 3 months there. While he was engaged in the recording of 6 episodes of The Walking Dead, a XXX horror-rated zombie killer thriller, which comes out in October.
Oh, fantastic, man. I'm into the zombies, too.
Oh, yeah, well, then sure. Check out, just Google The Walking Dead, and you will see my son-in-law, Andrew Lincoln, doing a hopefully convincing job of being a...
is he a zombie?
State trooper from Alabama or wherever.
All right, I was going to ask, is he a zombie killer or is he...
No, he's definitely a zombie killer. I think his zombie count was in the upper 20s by the time they did the rap party.
Fantastic. You know, all us horror fans, we love our zombies. We really do. Now, there's a couple of things that I did want to discuss with you, because I think it's very important. I don't know how often people... here in the States get to find out a little bit about you and some of the things that you've accomplished in your life. And besides being a wonderful talent and musician and songwriter and an entrepreneur and a philanthropist, you've done so many things in your life, and you seem to give back and really care not only about the music but also about life in general and helping out and doing things for people. I understand that you were awarded the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, or the MBE. And I wanted to ask you, that was awarded to you in 2008. Was the MBE something that you are honored by or not? Can you tell us how you feel about that whole thing and what's it about?
Well, famously, the Beatles, or at least some of them, gave theirs back when they were similarly in the Queen's Honor List back in the early days of their career. And they did that for personal or political reasons, but I wouldn't do that. That would be very churlish. I mean, they ask you in the first place, very quietly, you know, are you happy to receive such a thing?
Sure.
So there's, no one wants the embarrassment of them being flung back over the gates of Buckingham Palace or anything. But, you know, it's a peer group kind of an award. It's a recognition of something from people of your generation who have, through whatever mysterious processes exist, decided that you should be recognized for some work, you know, whatever it might be, in the public domain or perhaps just being a dedicated, you know, village school teacher or whatever it might be. It covers
sure.
everybody right across society, and you know, from rich industrialists down to the most humble of people serving their community, perhaps in some remote part of the country. So it spans. I mean, it's what I call the Village Postman Award. You know, it's okay. Something that is really for, you know, kind of everybody.
Okay.
And so, of course, it has to be an honor to be recognized by that. But it's, on the other hand, to do what many people do, which is to put the letters after their name on their personal stationery, well, that wouldn't be my style at all.
Okay.
You know, just, you know, things that have been awarded to you in recognition are very very nice to you know, for you to not acknowledge in a personal and private way,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily something you want to, you know, kind of dangle around your neck or
sure.
wear it on your lapel or
sure.
have it in the, you know, on the dashboard of your car or something. You know, you don't need to tell people who you are.
Yeah. It's something here on this side of the pond that we don't know much about. You know, we attribute it to something of honor for British citizens who are doing something or giving something or contributing something to society in general or in some way. So we view it here in this country as quite an honorable thing. And so it's not something that we hear about every day in America.
Right. Well, it's a little bit of the old world.
The old world, yes.
It's something that has sort of historical references. I guess it's, in the kind of context of the USA, this would seem rather quaint and almost a little kind of Mary Poppins like.
Okay,
it's part of our rather quaint English way of life. And but of course, people do get they may not get MBEs, OBEs, or knighthoods in America, but of course they're recognized in many other ways.
And, oh, sure.
You know, like getting a special deal with the IRS or or whatever. I'd settle for a much better relationship with the IRS, but, you know, being a U.S. taxpayer at around the 43% tax rate, paying state withholding as well as federal withholding taxes on all my earnings, I feel the pain.
You feel the pain along with every one of us here in America. So,
well, that's right. I was just, as we started talking, I was just checking out the dollar exchange rate today, and in fact, just in the last 24 hours, the dollar has crept up a cent or so, which is, And see, my wife already knew it was 1.53 to the UK pound because we keep an eye on these things.
Being
in possession of some bank accounts of different currencies,
sure,
so we have to watch what we're doing when we're moving money around. But yeah, it's a tough world, and both in the UK and in the USA, I think we've had a little pain to bear in the last few days, when recognition of the fact that it's not going to get a whole lot better anytime soon, which is perhaps a little more painful for Mr. Obama than it is for our new Prime Minister, Mr. Cameron, because
yeah.
he came into it at a point where everybody really knew the bitter pill had to be swallowed, whereas I think when Obama got in, there was still this slightly romanticized idea that everything was going to be okay. Of course it isn't.
Well, you know what? I'm so glad to hear that for, perspective from you. It's wonderful to hear that because, you're right on the money with that. No, it's not what we. It's not the yellow brick road. That's for sure.
No, well, tough time for all politicians who've had to take on that big cloak of responsibility in the last year or two. And you know, I think, but the trouble is, I think with the Obama administration, there's actually anger, bitterness, and a feeling of betrayal amongst a lot of Americans, whereas, you know, we haven't quite got that with our new prime minister, because I think everybody is actually a little more sympathetic to the enormity of the problem and the fact that within our next 4 or 5 years of government,
mm-hmm.
you know, the chances are we're not going to be a whole lot better off at the end of it than we are now. But of course, Obama's coming up to a halfway juncture at the moment, and things are looking bad because you know, he's already had some time to try and make some impact, and things haven't gone his way. So it's a rough ride. I wouldn't like to be Mr. Obama. I think he deserves more than he's getting, but you can see how he's getting a little tight-lipped and a little grim and a little bit besieged, I think, in his position, and he senses the wolves at the door.
Yes.
And whether or not whether or not he can manage to maintain the dignity and the survival instinct without getting too embittered remains to be seen. But he's got a tough job coming up, and I suppose you can only tell yourself, well, who else is there? I mean, you know, who else is there? It's kind of hard to find anyone that you say, well, so-and-so should have got the job, you know. Sarah Palin, she would have sorted out that oil spill in no time flat. You know,
please.
Well, she might have done. She probably would have transferred it to Alaska, where it's going to happen there sooner or later. So,
yeah,
scary stuff, scary stuff.
Very, very scary stuff.
The only thing that intrigues me about Sarah Palin is the fact that she is a flute player.
Okay.
And anyone who you know can play a bit of flute can't be all bad. So, I mean, she can probably slay a moose at 50 paces with her flute.
She probably could, man.
Yeah.
You know, she's quite the shot, I hear. So
yeah, high up sharp at 50 paces, she could just knock it over. Yeah.
Oh,
there
man.
We go.
How's the farm? How are all the animals on the farm and
everything? Well, we don't really have farm animals. We
well, you have some cats and you do.
Oh well, domestic animals, yeah.
Yes,
and chickens, and there's usually a few sheep knocking around, and cats and dogs and that sort of stuff. But no, not a commercial farming operation. I would find that rather difficult. Although I've been involved in farming animals over the years, I'm not really a big enough fan of eating meat, I suppose, to want to do it commercially. It's not something that would appeal to me really at all. Although I did eat some ostrich last night, and it was rather tasty.
Oh, what did it taste like? And don't tell me chicken.
No, I won't, actually. It was like a very, very succulent and really sort of really fine-flavored, kind of almost like a veal, but it was...
Oh, wow.
It was a really, really easy chew.
Oh, wow.
If you've got a 63-year-old mouth like me and you have to go to the back page of the Denny's menu to look for the pre-chewed steak for seniors, then, you know, an easy chew is welcome. And, yeah, ostrich is pretty good for that. I think absolutely low fat as well. Brilliant stuff. But then, you know, I could say the same thing about wild boar, another good thing to eat. Most of our wild game birds are good things to eat. And I'd rather eat things that have... kind of been on the that have enjoyed their lives in the wild rather than being captive bred in intensive circumstances on the farm. So I guess when it comes to meat eating, I'll probably be the caddy for Ted Nugent. Carry his crossbow for him.
Well, Uncle Ted's a friend of ours. We've talked to him several times over the years, and well, you don't need to any information for me to find out what Uncle Ted's all about. We all know what his story's all about. And
if you eat what you shoot, then that's fair enough.
And, I think that's
the way it should be. I imagine Ted has skinned a squirrel or two in his time, and they're pretty hard to skin.
Well, he's told me quite the story about some of the shots that he's made over his hunting escapades, and pretty impressive shots that he's done with pistols and so forth. But yeah, he's definitely an American icon, and still well loved and well respected here in Pennsylvania, especially because of his advocacy for hunting and so forth. And Pennsylvania, you're coming to Penn's Woods. Let's talk a little bit about the venue you're coming to. You're coming to a place called Penn's Peak, and I don't know, have you played there before, Ian? Do you remember?
No, we haven't. It's one of those places that's a delightful mystery to me on the map, because one of the things I really do enjoy about touring, not only in the USA but around the world, is the opportunity to visit places I haven't been to before, and there are a lot of them. So on every tour and every year, I try and make sure that we do find some places that are, for us, virgin territory, and it is nice to find somewhere on the map that, you know, has a little theater and somewhere I can go and play and drop in on, and you know, amongst all the other better known places that we visit, particularly in the USA, time and time again. But you know, I really like the idea of finding a part of the country I'm not familiar with, and since we drive everywhere during the daylight hours, we get to see a little bit of the countryside and maybe stop and have lunch somewhere. And so part of getting to know the nooks and crannies of a great country that perhaps it's all too easy to take for granted and form an opinion about based on what you see on television or That's watch what you see from the freeway.
Yeah,
and that's not necessarily America. What the truth of the matter.
No, that is not America. What you see on television is by far a total distortion of what America truly is. I don't view Hollywood as giving us any quality representation of life in America. It's a totally they're totally out of touch with what's going on in the country. So definitely, you know, for someone who's a performer and tours the world, you can make that valid opinion, and it rings true that this country is far more than what you see on television, and we have a very genuine spirit of independence in this country, and many of us feel that that our politicians are ignoring us, and there's time for some real change is needed here in this country, and things are rough over here. Things are hard. But I wanted to tell you that you're coming to a place. It's called Penn's Peak, and you've never played the room. But I wanted to tell you that acoustically, I think you're going to be very pleased with the room.
If you're going to tell me that you can hear every note crystal clear, that's the last thing I want to hear.
What
I want to know is that I can play lots of wrong notes and you're not going to notice them. That's what I really want to hear.
You can. But you know what you're going to get? You're going to get a beautiful, nice, warm tone from the room, which I think most musicians really appreciate.
Well, a nice warm tone from the room, but a chilling, screeching honk from my flute. That's the unfortunate thing is, how much flute can anyone listen to in an evening? I've actually been to some flute concerts when it's just been flute, flute, flute all night, and I've come close to, you know, giving up at the end of an hour or two. It is just the most insufferable instrument if that's what you have to listen to nonstop. So luckily, I don't have to play it all the time.
No, you play
more.
Quite
a few places where I put that down and strum a guitar instead, or leave it up to some of the other musicians to be entertaining for a while, and I can clear off altogether for a precious 3 minutes at the nearest gentleman's lavatory.
Which there's plenty of in abundance there at Penn's Peak. You're going to love the room, I believe, and I think you'll love the location. It's kind of nestled in the hills of the Poconos, and it's a very picturesque place. And please be sure to go out and check out the view, because it's just beautiful up there, and that's a good representation of what it's like up here in Pennsylvania. And you will have a wonderful attendance, I'm sure, because it's a very popular venue here in the Lehigh Valley area. And we're just glad that you actually made some time to visit this part of the state. I see that your tour is going to take you out until November. And you'll be hitting the eastern part of the United States, and then you'll be going down to Florida in November, back up through Virginia, and then ending in New York as well. So you've got quite the tour planned.
Yeah, well, it's all pretty much drivable, which is good. We split it up into two tours, start up in Canada and head down, and so we get about a bit, but we try and make it all, apart from maybe one or two little longer trips. It's mostly kind of 3-hour drives, and that's quite tolerable. I don't drive, my wife drives, and happily she's a good and confident driver, except on Interstate 91, where a lot of big trucks 95 sorry she's
95.
Correcting me, 95, where a lot of big trucks go steaming down through New England all the way down the seaboard, and they're pretty angry.
Yeah.
I don't know what the drivers are, but the trucks look pretty angry, belching black smoke, shedding tires all over the hard shoulder and so on. So yes, it can be a little daunting, but once we get out on some of the more rural routes, it's kind of quite nice to see a bit of the world. And once in a while, we take some cross country route that lets us experience a little bit of the real America. You know, and we feel like we're in that movie Deliverance, where we might encounter some local inhabitants of an interesting sort.
You never know,
especially
if you go through, you know, Virginia and Tennessee and places like that. It's very easy to probably find people like that. I make a trip annually down to South Carolina. My daughter lives there, and I don't go down 95. I take 81 and go south and go through the mountains of Virginia, the Appalachians, and it's amazing how much of this country is truly unsettled yet. People don't realize how vast this country is, and so much of it is still unsettled. You know, when you get to your metropolitan areas, it's a different thing. But here in Pennsylvania, you can drive about 25, 30 minutes from any large metropolitan area and find the woods, which we're very happy and we enjoy here in Pennsylvania. I wanted to ask you about this. Do you ever get referred to as Dr. Anderson because of the honorary doctorate you received in literature?
I think the only time I've ever been addressed that way is by the university who awarded me the degree. I think just as a reminder that I am, in their eyes, Dr. Ian Anderson, and therefore I ought to be turning up to speak to their students on a regular basis or something.
Yes, but, you do.
No, of course nobody does that sort of thing. And if I should be on a long-haul airplane flight and some poor woman is giving birth in the back of the plane and they announce over the intercom, "Is there a doctor in the house?" then, you know, hell, I'll be there, but I'm not sure that I'm going to be much good.
Well, I wanted to say congratulations to you, Ian, for being recognized. You also were recognized with the Ivor Novella Award. Can you tell the listener a little bit about that? That was in 2006 as well. So that was a bang-up year for you in 2006.
Yeah, well, I think it must have been... it must have been one of those, I think I was probably approaching my 60th birthday or whatever, so perhaps that was something to do with it. Maybe they didn't think I was going to last too much longer, better give me these awards
on
while I'm still around. But yeah, the Ivor Novello Award is awarded by one of our essentially institutes of British songwriters, and it covers all aspects of music, from classical music to television and film music through to, you know, the flimsiest and whimsical of pop music. But it is a recognition of musical songwriting and music writing, which most recipients are, you know, very honoured to receive. But you know, it's outside of the UK. I wouldn't have thought it meant anything at all. It's rather like you know, we have these big things that go on in terms of awards for. You know, some more glitzy and TV and glamorous oriented kind of awards that are more like the Grammys or the Emmys or the Oscars or whatever, and those sort of things exist elsewhere in Europe. But it's more about showbiz and wearing a nice frock.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look in my wardrobe, the frocks are a bit thin on the ground. Actually, I'm not very good at dressing up for those sort of occasions, and feel quite uncomfortable and out of place. So I try and avoid them as a whole and hope that people aren't going to give me awards, otherwise I have to get dressed up in order to go and receive them, which is is a bit difficult. But the same with charity dinners. You know, you go to some charity dinner where you're, you know, everybody's dressed up, and I feel, you know, just can't find the right things to wear that I'm going to be comfortable in. But, you know, it's... I mean, when I went to... not too long ago, was hosted by a well-known TV personality in the UK, and it essentially for a charity that counsels mostly young gay people with AIDS, and it's the biggest charity of its kind in the UK, and a lot of people in the music and show business generally support it, whether they're homosexual, heterosexual, or from Mars. I mean, you know, we all turn up and sort of support inevitably those kind of causes. But I felt so out of place, you know, because everybody else was... I mean, most of the guys were wearing nice frocks, and so I don't have anything like that to wear. I just felt so un-gay. Uncool and un-gay. And, you know, I could have... God, you know, it was a bit like... you know, it's a bit like being Ted Nugent at a gay pride march.
Oh, thoroughly entertaining you are, Ian. It's so refreshing to talk to you and hear you speak like this, because, you know, it's so obvious. You're a very articulate man and very intelligent man, but truly you have a sensibility and... there's such a down-to-earthness about you, Ian, that, you know, comes through in your music, comes through with you on stage. Many of us, when we watch you perform, we do feel connected to you. So it's obvious, you know, speaking to you in a phone interview, that all of the celebrity and all of the awards and all of these things, sure, they're nice to get, but really, when it comes down to it, you really are truly dedicated to your craft, and we want to thank you for that, Ian. It's so nice to see a man of your accomplishments still remain truly humbled by what you've done, and continue to be humbled by the audiences that come to see you, and just be a regular bloke. And I want to thank you for sharing that part of yourself with us today.
No problem at all. And lest I sound as if I'm being too self-effacing, if you played as many wrong notes as I do on a typical concert evening, then humble is the only way to be. Trust me. Anyway, good to talk to you, and look forward to seeing you in a couple of, well, not a couple of weeks, but in a few weeks' time.
Yes. Well,
fantastic.
I'm looking forward to at least perhaps saying hello and shaking your hand.
Good. Well, please do stop by, and we'll do that.